Welcome to the intoxicating world of wine. A grape can be held between your thumb and forefinger, and we might consider it an easy fruit to grow. But beneath the vineyards of Bordeaux, a geological drama has been taking place over the past 38 million years. Across faults and folds, interglacials, through ice ages. Can maps dictate how something will taste? I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. In this series, we speak to people who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. Jane Anson is one of the world's most respected writers on wine. She's not only a leading authority on the wines of Bordeaux, she's lived there for the past 20 years, developing an unparalleled knowledge of the region and its wines. In her book, Inside Bordeaux, The Château, Their Wines and the Terroir, she's taken a new approach to this most famous of wines. The book has mapped Bordeaux to enable anyone interested in wine to understand it in new and exciting ways. Jane, welcome to What's Your Map? And you have brought a map here. Can you unfurl this and tell me what we're looking at here?
I'm loving that you're using the word unfurl. And can I just say thank you so much for having me on this show.
It's a pleasure.
I'm very excited. I've been a bit of a map geek since I was a little girl, and I had one of those old-fashioned globes next to my bed. And my aunt, Sheila, did voluntary service overseas in Malawi when she was in her 20s. And I can remember when I was little, looking at the globe and trying to find Africa and having like a dream that one day I was going to go and travel to Malawi. So
in the end, wine and maps were going to come together.
They were always going to come together.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating because there is something very innovative that you've been working on here with mapping this region of Bordeaux. Just tell me about this map and what we're looking at here.
Sure. So in front of us, we've got a map that is looking... So Bordeaux basically is two sides, or two, call the two banks of Bordeaux. One is the left bank, one is the right bank. And everything's more complicated than what I'm going to tell you, but who cares? Let's get into it. So there's a main river that basically goes between those two that's called the Garonne River. And where we are looking is here. There's the Gironde estuary. The Gironde estuary is actually the biggest estuary in Western Europe. It's huge. And it goes from anything of like a couple of kilometres wide right up to 10 kilometres wide at its widest point. So it really makes a big influence on the wines. So what we're looking at here is the left bank of this Gironde estuary, Garonne River, and we're in a place called the Médoc. So the Médoc, if anyone who's listening and drinks Bordeaux wines, the Médoc is probably the most famous part of Bordeaux, where you have these appellations that make pretty fancy, sometimes expensive wines called Saint-Julien, Pauillac, and Saint-Estèphe. So those are three villages on the left bank of Bordeaux in the Médoc.
And these are the villages, and the appellations are...
So they're the villages and the names of the appellations.
And what's an appellation exactly?
It's basically a winemaking area.
So from left to right, we've got, I can see the Saint-Laurent, Saint-Julien, Pauillac, my favourite wine. And these are from left to right, Saint-Estèphe over here.
So this map is showing you a lot of different villages, wine villages. So they'll be making wine all over this map. But as you can see, there are different colours on my map.
I mean, I look at this map and it looks to me, I think it's a physical map because it's got a scale, it's got orientation, and then it's also colour-coded with these oranges and greens and browns. And I see here, these are about gravel terraces from brown through into orange. So what is a terrace exactly?
So, yes, if you're a normal wine map would be showing mainly just green and it would just have the names of the chateaus and you would just be looking at the location of the chateaus. These added bits with the colours are showing what is lying underneath. So you go to the Médoc, You head up to one of these chateaus and you see their beautiful chateau building. You can knock on the door, you go in the tasting room, but you can't see without this map what is happening under, as you know, where you're standing, what's happening underground. And so these different colours are the terraces, which are basically mounds of gravel with varying degrees of sand and clay and varying heights away from the sea level. That's what these different colours are. So we have here, there are actually six terraces in the Medoc. So T1 to T6, mm-hmm. Terrace 1 to Terrace 6. But in this particular area, it is mainly Terrace 3, Terrace 4 and Terrace 5. A little bit of Terrace 1. And what they mean is they go back many, many, many centuries, obviously, to really explain what the terrace is. Think about the whole of Bordeaux. There's a right bank and the left bank. Right? So we split Bordeaux into two. This is where everything I say, you're going to have an exception because it's much more complicated. But generally speaking, split Bordeaux into two. The right bank is higher and older. So you can go right up to 100 metres, 120 metres on the right bank of Bordeaux, and you'll have these lovely limestone cliffs. Looks very, very beautiful. And that land, generally speaking, is much older, hasn't changed for millennia. Over here on the left bank, the land is much lower, closer to the ocean, and over the generations, because it has the Garonne River coming in, there's also a river called the Dordogne that's coming from central France. That goes through the right bank, and they both, the Dordogne and the Garonne River, meet up in this Gironde estuary that we're talking about here. So they're bringing all of this deposits, you know, from the mountains, and because the left bank is lower, and you had only about 10,000 years ago, you had a sea level rise, which also brought in extra deposits from the sea. So put that all together and you end up with a ton of gravel that is at different levels, because as the sea has receded and come back, it's left different levels of gravel. And so today they have been codified into Terrace 1, Terrace 2, Terrace 3, Terrace 4, Terrace 5 and Terrace 6.
And I can see them here and you can see the contour lines, so you can get a sense of elevation and how what you would describe as the terroir is influencing the grape and therefore the wine. And the big hitters that I know of, these are the sweet spots, right? So these in the orange, the mid-terraces, Saint-Estève, Saint-Julien, Pauillac. These are the key feet. For me, anyway, I look at this and I think, aha, this is what we're really talking about.
That's exactly right. And what's really kind of cool is you can think that this is very flat land, and it is, really. However, if you go to, you know, the difference between being on the top of the terrace and the bottom, it happens very quickly. So you can be at 5 metres and then you can be down at 1 metre very quickly. So you actually have quite big slopes. So those slopes are really important because we're by the coast here, it's Atlantic, you do get rain, you need to be able to have drainage. So having those slopes are very important for drainage and also very important to expose the grapes to the sun, because having a little bit of a slope helps the sun hit more of the grapes as they're ripening. So those tiny changes are actually very important. The sweet spot terraces are Terrace 3 and Terrace 4, which you've got an awful lot of in Pauillac, Saint-Julien and Saint-Estève on this map. And just to link that to money, because I think often it shouldn't be, but it is quite a good way to clarify what we're talking about. So I'm showing the map we're looking at. There are plenty of winemaking areas on this map where you can see chateau names, but they don't have that orange or the dark grey.
Yeah.
So if you're there, you might be making very nice wine, but it's probably you've bought that land, or you could sell your land for maybe 50,000 euros a hectare, maybe 100,000 if you're on a particularly good bit. Go down to these three appellations where you see Terrace 3 or Terrace 4, you're talking 1.5 million, 2 million, 2.5 million euros per hectare, which is 2.5 acres of land. So the difference is huge.
Why is this so blue chip?
So I'm going to tell you what's just really blew my mind when I was doing the research for this map. There's a big wine ranking that I'm sure you know about. It's like the world's first culinary ranking.
This is a fabulous story. I love this because I didn't know about this when the wines are basically classified.
Yeah,
is this
so
right?
Based out of Paris. So what's happening? You've got to go back to 1789, French Revolution. Well, the rest of Europe starts thinking, hang on a minute, I'm not sure I want to do business with France anymore. There's all monarchies around Europe at the time. They've chopped off the head of their monarch. So most other monarchy countries are a little bit nervous about doing business with the French. By the mid-19th century, Napoleon has stabled things out. It's onto the next. It's onto Napoleon III. 1851 in London was a brilliant success. So the Crystal Palace exhibition. And Napoleon III thought, right, I need to do something to show that France is open for business again. So they did this great exhibition, kind of showcased lots of French industry. And one of those things was wine. And the merchants of Bordeaux, in fact, the brokers of Bordeaux, got together and they really made a list of the most expensive wines in Bordeaux that happened to be over on the left bank in this area that we're looking at, a few other places, but let's talk about just this bit of the map. And they listed 61 wines in five categories, so from first growth to fifth growth. This is the thing that blew my mind. Okay, we all think, oh, that's just, they were the most wealthy people. They were the people that were the richest. That's why their wines got into there. But if you look, where are those chateaus situated? Bearing in mind there are six gravel terraces in the Medoc, every single one of the 1855 61 wines are on Terrace 3 and Terrace 4. And there's no way that they knew in the mid-19th century at that detail that they were on the terraces. What they were going on was how good the wines tasted and how much they were making in the marketplace.
But the map shows you
that. The map shows it. And so I don't think anyone had really put those two things together until I was doing this research for Inside Bordeaux. There's a French guy called Pierre Bechelet who had come up with the, had seen and mapped these six terraces, but hadn't then taken it on to make the link between what did it mean, and certainly not in terms of what does it mean for the taste. I'm coming at it as a non-geologist. I'm coming at it as somebody who's interested in the taste of wine, and also in translating what does that mean to the general public, myself included. Like, why does a Saint-Estèphe wine taste different from a Saint-Julien? And so I just found when you suddenly start to see, let's break down these terraces, six terraces. The first one, Terrace 1, is the highest and the oldest. Terrace 6 is the lowest and the youngest. And I'm talking here about close proximity to the river.
And so, what's the oldest on the map here?
So we don't see Terrace 1 on here. Well, I've got another map coming out soon that does show Terrace 1. But on this particular bit, actually because this is such high quality, there is no Terrace 1. So Terrace 1, weirdly, although it's the highest, and you might think that should mean it's the best, in the Medoc it doesn't. The Medoc basically rewrites the rules. It's another reason why it's such a fun area. Yeah. Being close to the river is the best thing in the Medoc because the river will bring cooling breezes. It guards against frost. It keeps everything kind of regulated. So it really gives a much more steady ripening. So close to the river is good. Terrace 6 is a bit too close. It's a bit too low. The vines get a bit wet and a bit, they're just not, a bit soggy, not perfect. But once you get to Terrace 4 and Terrace 3, you're in the sweet spot. Right. And so you get these beautiful wines.
Was there a moment where you realised that doing this and the geography and the geology and the environment needed the map and that's what you needed to put together, that would somehow bring a greater understanding of the wines? Because that blows my mind. Why didn't anybody do this before, Jane?
It's such a good question. I almost think we're looking at one small bit of Bordeaux here. The actual, all of Bordeaux is the biggest fine wine region in France. And to date, Burgundy has kind of got the stamp of approval on terroir. Like, the way we completely understand Burgundy wines is through their tiny little plots of land. They're called climat over in Burgundy. We're all used to understanding that soil makes a difference in Burgundy. We're not used to thinking of it in Bordeaux. And I almost think it's because it's so big and so complicated. So we discussed today between me bringing this map and one on the right bank in Saint-Emilion, you'd see the colours were completely different. They're bright yellows over there because it's mainly limestone. They're so different. And I wonder, was it just too complicated in Bordeaux to even begin? So it was just easier to talk about brands, history, personalities. I don't know. I try and lay them both together because there's no question it's fun to talk about the egos and the history of Bordeaux in that way as well.
Just explain this idea about terroir to me, because it's a complicated term, isn't it, across the two different banks.
You can either give one word answer or you can dive right in for days. But simply put, terroir is, yes, it's about the soil, but it's also about the microclimate. It's about the altitude from the, you know, from the sea level, or in this case from the river level. Also, it's about the person who has developed it, the man. So one of the big kind of questions in terroir is it just God-given soils and contour lines, or is it also the hand that humanity or the humans have had in developing that And I feel, and agree strongly with the French, which not everybody does, but I think there's no such thing as terroir without the man who developed it, and the man or the woman who developed it, the person who did.
We're talking about a 1,000-year-old tradition of making wine also in the region. And then also in the 12th and 13th century, something I didn't know enough about was the involvement of the English, and that still drives a certain way in which the wine is being bought and sold, isn't it? I just thought this was extraordinary. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
You know, I just often say to people that it makes me feel like I'm never too far from home when I'm in Bordeaux. So I left England. I was living in London before. I was born in Oxford, but I was living in London. And I moved to Bordeaux in 2003. And I don't think I also fully understood those links. But really, the figure of Eleanor of Aquitaine, who married a guy called Henry, a guy, a year before he was a duke, became the King of England, so Henry Plantagenet. Yeah. And their marriage brought together this kingdom of Aquitaine that she was the Duchess of and the English crown. And prior to that, she'd been married to the French king. I mean, she was a super interesting woman. Very beautiful, very willful, just incredible.
And married an English and a French king, and then ends up sort of being involved in
the only woman in history, as far as I'm aware, that was queen of England and queen of France. So pretty amazing. And yeah, so this lasted for 300 years, the duchy, it was the duchy of the crown of England, this whole region. Because of that, the English crown was kind of wanting to keep the Bordeaux winemakers sweet, to keep them on side. And so they gave them all kinds of benefits, like paying no taxes. All of their wine got to be shipped off from Bordeaux over to England and Ireland later and Scotland before any other wines from that same southwest France. So there was about 300 years of where Bordeaux wines were building up all of this renown in an international level. It's really one of the things I love so much about Bordeaux wine is you can go into it as a historian, you can go into it as a geographer, you can go into it as an economist, because you find, particularly again, these very famous 1855 wines, the world's most successful people economically, socioeconomically, through history have bought those wines. So you go right back to the 16th century, and it's the guys with money who are buying these Lafites and Latours and the wines we're talking about here. So it's why I can understand that that became a shortcut. So people kind of forgot why were they good? And that goes back to what the soil is like.
And what the map shows, and it just strikes me, is the controversy in terms of this work and the maps that you've been producing? Are you taking on a certain...
I love your question. So one of the things I wanted to do is there are not just 61 chateaus on this lovely orange strip. And I'm a big Terrace 4 girl. If I'm gonna pick my terrace, I love Terrace 4 because it has a little bit more clay among the gravel, and that means it's a bit more powerful. So it's really a fun way to look at it. But anyway, my point is there aren't just those 61 expensive wines. There are also cheaper, lesser known chateaus on these terraces. So I think this can be a great way for consumers to look and not have to spend. There are a couple of hundred euros that you have to spend on, say, I don't know, a Léoville Lescasse or a Lafite Rothschild. You can look and see what's nearby that also has that same brilliant terroir. So on this map that we're looking at, you've got here Saint-Julien, Pauillac, Saint-Estèphe. So they're the three big guns in terms of the villages. Just pop over the map to the far right-hand corner and you see a village that's called Saint-Seurin-de-Cadourne. Now that, for me, if you're like a value picker in Bordeaux or for Bordeaux wines, look to that village because it's a great village. And you can see here, look at all that bright orange. Terrace 3. It's got some fantastic wines in that particular village. And they're not classified because they weren't owned maybe by somebody famous in 1855. Whatever reason, they didn't go up that far. I mean, let's remember in 1855, the brokers were going on horseback from the city centre of Bordeaux. It was taking them a couple of days to get up here. So the further you went up the Medoc, the less likely you were to be being kind of tracked by these brokers from Bordeaux. So this is a village which, for me, tons of high-quality wines that are not yet really being given their due.
And it's the map and the terroir which shows you that, not about the name and that tradition. But then I have to ask you, we're talking about the science and the maps, which is great, about the magic of Bordeaux for you. I mean, I know that you went there, I think, for a couple of years, and you've been there over 20. And there's clearly a love of it. You've been both a sort of disciple, but now you're a teacher of wine as well. I mean, you're clearly so invested in it. What is it about the magic? I mean, I love drinking Bordeaux. But for you, what is the magic of the region and the wines in contrast maybe to other places?
It's this mix of wherever you throw a stone in Bordeaux and you're going to come up with a story that doesn't just date to the last 5 years. It dates back maybe 1,000 years or even 2,000 years, because the Romans were the first people to actually plant vines here. But because there is, well, now it's tough, actually. There's less money for the lower levels right now. They're struggling. But generally speaking, there's a constant sense of renewal in Bordeaux, because it's the kind of area that attracts new people in. So you have these old families who might have been making wine for 600, 700 years. There's a couple of chateaus that are extremely old families. And then you'll have a new tech entrepreneur who's maybe made a bit of money in maybe luxury or is coming over from San Francisco, and he comes and he starts in a new estate. So you've got this kind of dual highways of the people who've been there for a long time and always somebody new. And there's always something to fight about in Bordeaux, which makes it fun as a writer. So you have people who prefer the left bank to the right bank, yeah. People who prefer Cabernet Sauvignon to Merlot, people who prefer Terrace 3 to Terrace 4. That's a very niche subset of people. But I'm hoping to increase those people.
When you were making the maps, I'm curious about really what drove that as well, and what you found out when you started looking into the history of the region and how it had been mapped before the maps in your book.
So, I mean, as you know, and there is no such thing as a map is a collaborative effort of many, many people, and I am not a geologist. I underline that strongly. So these maps, so there was Pierre Bechelet who had mapped these gravel terraces. We worked with a really wonderful Dutch guy, ironically, because of the Dutch role in the Medoc, but a Dutch professor who's called Kees van Leeuwen, who is really a complete genius. And we have 58 different maps that we did for this book, and he looked over all of them to be sure that they were consistent, to be sure that the colours we were using were correct as far as the colours used in French geology maps generally. And that was fantastic. But then we had the English team, because obviously inside Bordeaux is English. And we had a woman cartographer who's brilliant called Leanne Kelman, who did the drawing. And then a woman called Lizzie Ballantyne, who designed. But I really want to give a special real gratitude to my publisher, who's called Chris Folks. And what Chris had done, in the 1990s, he worked with a very famous wine writer called Michael Broadbent, who did the first Bordeaux Atlas. And it was the first time that there had really been maps done, and honestly, not to the detail that we did in this one, but they were brilliant, brilliant maps. They didn't look at terroir. They looked at the location of the chateaus, and they very importantly looked at the contour lines. So when we said earlier on, Bordeaux is not, well, this part of Bordeaux, the Medoc, is not high, but the contours make a massive difference.
And you can see, the elevation, see it's a them. Map of elevation.
Exactly, you see it very, very carefully. And that was really put in the Bordeaux Atlas for the first time. Now, when the Bordeaux Atlas was published, Chris Folks was contacted by the kind of French equivalent of the Ordnance Survey people, saying, hang on a minute, how have you been able to do these maps? I think you probably owe us a ton of money for the copyright. Mm. And so Chris was able to say, well, you might think that, but actually, our researcher found these maps in the Imperial War Museum or in some archives in England, and they had been mapped by the Luftwaffe during World War II. And the reason they did that, so the actual original copyright of these maps, which had passed out of copyright, was, I think, what do they call them? The Army High Command War Maps Survey Office, Paris, 1943 to 1944.
Wow. So it's 43 to 44. That was the sort of backbone of these mapping.
And why was this area mapped? It goes right back to the idea of this is a peninsula. Here's the Atlantic Ocean. Bordeaux is a very, very important port and has been for 2,000 years. And as we know, during World War II, the entire Atlantic seaboard was being manned. And so what the Luftwaffe did, they were part of a big area that was called the Geographical Service of the German Army, which had been under Nazi control, obviously, in 1930s up to 1945. And they had been flying reconnaissance missions all over Europe, not just Europe, Middle East, Soviet Union, wherever the places that they were thinking they were going to be invading. And so they were very carefully mapping where were the places that they could easily get in, what was the kind of terrain that the army was going to have to be crossing, all of this incredible detailed information.
So a terroir, but for a different reason.
For a different reason. And now I listened to one of your fabulous podcasts recently, and you said, maps have always served the interests of power and authority and always linked to military tactics. And when I heard you saying that, I thought, I know we're going to get on, because that was just exactly what the base of these maps was.
But that sounds so solemn. Your map is much more interesting.
Now it's beautifully
coloured.
It's
a map of the wines that I drink. So it is. But that is, I mean, it's true in a way, but it's also fascinating what you've done, because, you know, there's so much snobbery around the wine. And I'm sure that you, I mean, you're such a great person who will kind of take that apart. And the maps really do that, because there's a way in which you can understand what terroir is in a more complex way. And I can now understand, without being a bit snobby, when I drink some of those wines, I now get some of the sense. I mean, you've done this in such greater detail, but it now does make some sense. And for me, it's quite a shock that this wasn't really known, that the Bordeaux had this certain tradition. And it seems to me fascinating, because it's about land, isn't it? It's about land and money, and the map in the middle starts to tell you a different story.
Yeah, and I really also feel so just privileged to have been able to start that, you know, to kind of continue that conversation. And truly, if you can take this idea of terroir, and then every single year you can just get a rough, you know, look at the weather. Was it a hot year? Was it a wet year? And what we're finding now is we get increasingly drought summers where there really is not a lot of rain, and it can be a real problem. And you wonder, some of these very deep gravel terraces, which in history have given the best wines because they get ripe, is that going to become a problem? Because they get too ripe, so you might lose some of that beauty that you get, the nuance. Like the thing about a grape is you really want to get the sweet spot, because as soon as you go over ripe, you start getting alcohols being too high, you lose some of that aromatic nuance, all the stuff that we don't realise why we like wine, but when you don't have it, you realise it's not there.
The reason I love listening to you talk about wine is because you're a writer first, and then you, as it were, trained in wine. Where does that interest come from? How did one lead to the other?
So, how far back should we go?
As far as you want.
I definitely can say that one of the things I feel so grateful to wine for is allowing me to write books. Because we said, go back to my childhood bedroom. Here's my globe next to the bed. And I'm looking at Africa and thinking, oh, one day I'm going to be going there. And when I graduated, I went to live in Japan for 1 year, and then I went to Hong Kong for 3 years. And I was in Hong Kong at the time of the handover. So as a journalist, that was just such a fascinating and super fun time to be there. Like, you really worked hard, but it was that real feel end of, you know, you knew there was a big change happening. So it was amazing. And I was writing generally travel. I was writing about, you know, politics. I was subbing on the South China Morning Post, just kind of doing the day job of becoming a journalist. And I wasn't sure what I would specialise in, really. It was much more of a generalist. And then we moved to Bordeaux when our first daughter was born. She's now 21. And we thought, oh, we'll just pop over, maternity leave, maybe a year, maybe 2 years. It'll just be fun. And then when I got there, my husband's from Highgate. He's a Londoner. But he was really the wine lover, much more than me. He was really the Bordeaux nut. And so we went because we thought it would be fun and interesting for him to maybe become a merchant specialising in Bordeaux wine, which he's done. And as I started writing about it, I got to Bordeaux and I was like, right, well, I'm a writer. I'm in Bordeaux. I might as well do what the Romans do and start looking into Bordeaux wine. But I came at it very much from the point of view of writing the news stories about what was happening there. I wasn't trying at first to understand the wine, because it felt so overwhelming to think, oh, I don't know anything about wine tasting. But the more I got to understand the geography of the place, and the more I understood the link with England, which I didn't necessarily know when I got there, and realised that, well, there was a place for me here, because I was part of this long continuum of people from Ireland and from England and from Scotland and from Germany and from Holland and from Spain and from all over the world, who've been attracted to Bordeaux as this important port city and have made something of it. So one of the reasons that we have heard of Bordeaux more than we've heard of Madiron or Cahors or these much smaller wine regions that also make great wine, also in southwest France, we haven't heard of them. The reason for that is because Bordeaux is a port city, and because it's always had these foreigners who have come become part of the fabric of the city and taken its fame, you know, around the world. Bordeaux sold in 170 different countries worldwide. Like, if there's a country that sells wine, it sells Bordeaux wine. Mm. So I now have my own website that specialises talking about Bordeaux wine. I could never have launched that if it wasn't for the fact that these many generations of international people have come and helped it kind of get the word spread. So I like being part of that continuum.
But that's wonderful. So your globe when you were a kid that you saw actually is connected to Bordeaux, because the story there is that it's one that's very international, because we think of it, and I think the exclusivity often is thought about the wine, that it's very French, and if you're not involved in that culture and language, you feel quite outside that. But it's not, strikes me. The Dutch influence is fascinating, because I know South Africa quite well. That's, of course, the moment where the Dutch are really kickstarting the wine industry in the Cape region, and it's around the same time.
It's so, interesting. And, you know, one of the reasons, I'm sure you do know, but one of the reasons why so many Dutch people left this area was because there were laws against Protestantism. So it's off they go to South Africa. It is. Yeah. I absolutely agree with you. I love that about wine. Yeah. Because it brings so many strands of history together. Mm. It's amazing.
There is a wonderful story about in the Cape, that where the Huguenots, when they go inland and they go over the mountains and they say, we're in Provence. It looks like we're in Provence.
That's amazing. And so those probably looking at Franschhoek or somewhere.
Exactly, Franschhoek,
like
So the next day, so now you have to map the wine regions in South Africa.
I would love to.
Would you mind? That would be quite nice.
My very first ever trip to a wine region was South Africa. In fact, this was really does connect back to my wonderful Aunt Sheila and her being in Africa. Because when I was leaving Hong Kong, I ended up going for 3 months to travel on my own through Africa. And I got to the Cape Winelands and I interviewed a guy called Jabulani, who was the first black manager. It was 2 years after apartheid had finished, and he was hired. He'd gone during apartheid off to New York and worked with a wine, starting in the warehouse and working his way up with a wine company there. And then after apartheid, he thought, well, I'm going to go back to South Africa and help kind of build the new South Africa. And I interviewed him, nothing to do with wine. I interviewed him as a journalist about what it was like coming back in. And so that was probably the first time that I thought, okay, there's something in wine that's very interesting.
Maps and wine.
Maps and wine.
Which leads me to ask you also, can you come back and we can do the next one and we can taste those wines, please? Would that be possible?
I'd love to. I'd so love chatting to you about this. Thank you for having me.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Jane Anson, thank you for joining me on What's Your Map?
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. The series producer is Emily Uchida Finch, and it's a Whistledown production.